Imagine for a second that you are running this massive operation. Like maybe it's a busy metropolitan hospital or a sprawling automotive manufacturing plant.
Right, something with a lot of moving parts.
Exactly. Or even, a regional logistics hub that handles thousands of packages an hour. And everything is just running like clockwork.
Until it isn't.
Yeah, until you get the word. Tomorrow morning, a really significant portion of your workforce is walking out on strike.
Wow. Yeah, that is the ultimate nightmare scenario for a manager.
Right, you're suddenly facing this reality of silent assembly lines or unstaffed nurse stations or just a fleet of trucks with literally no one to drive them. So what actually happens next?
You definitely don't just put a help wanted sign in the window, I can tell you that much.
No, you absolutely do not. You have to launch this highly sensitive, legally fraught, almost military grade operation. And that's what we're looking at today. We are doing a deep dive into an employer's guide from RSS Inc.
Yeah, it's a manual entirely focused on strike staffing and strike security.
Right. And the mission for this deep dive is to decode exactly how businesses attempt to survive when the gates lock and, the picket lines actually form.
It is a scenario that completely upends standard business logic. I mean, we really need to set the stage here by understanding that this source material, it isn't outlining a standard hiring push.
Not at all.
What we're looking at is this massive coordinated operation of workforce continuity. You are essentially dropping a replacement workforce into an environment that is emotionally charged, highly visible, and just incredibly fragile.
Yeah, the tension must be off the charts.
Oh, it is. And every single move has to be calculated. Because, the margin for error essentially drops to zero the second that strike begins.
Right. And before a company can even think about bringing, a single new worker into that charged environment, they have to grasp what the guide calls the two pillars of workforce continuity.
The twin pillars, yeah. Staffing and security.
Exactly. Yeah. And the document makes it abundantly clear that these two pillars, they cannot exist in isolation. They are treated as one completely integrated system.
Yeah, on one side, you've got the staffing pillar, right? So this handles the rapid acquisition of replacement labor, sorting out complex shift coverage, and the massive logistical hurdle of credential verification.
Oh, credential verification, like if you're staffing a hospital.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Or a specialized chemical plant. You have to verify beyond a shadow of a doubt that the person you just hired actually holds the licenses they claim to have.
Right. You can't just take their word for it when lives are on the line.
Exactly. And then on the other side is the security pillar. But we are not talking about standard, observe and report security guards here.
Right. It's way more intense than that.
Much more. This involves strict access control, orchestrating safe worker escorts through potentially hostile perimeters, and really just protecting the physical site from sabotage or disruption.
I was trying to visualize why the manual insists they are so utterly interdependent.
Mm.
And it's kind of like trying to perform delicate surgery in the back of a moving ambulance.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. The staffing team, the replacement workers, they're the surgeon. They have to do this highly technical, essential work under immense pressure.
And the security team is the driver of that ambulance.
Exactly. If the driver hits a pothole or takes a wrong turn into traffic.
Or, in this context, escalates a conflict at the picket line.
Right, exactly. Then the surgeon's scalpel slips. The operation completely fails.
Yeah, a replacement workforce simply cannot perform reliably without a secure, predictable operating environment. I mean, if workers feel unsafe entering the building or if supply trucks are physically blocked from reaching the loading dock, the labor just stops.
And the reverse is true as well, right? A locked-down, perfectly secure facility has absolutely zero value to the business if the essential work isn't happening inside.
Oh, totally. You can have the most secure perimeter in the world, but if the machines are quiet, the business is still bleeding money.
You absolutely need both pillars standing strong.
Which, brings up a massive operational challenge, because if you understand you need this dual approach, the immediate instinct for any management team facing a walkout is to just panic hire.
Oh, sure. Just get bodies in the door.
Right. They look at a spreadsheet of, say, 500 empty slots, and they just try to fill all 500 as fast as possible. But the manual stresses that hiring during a strike does not begin with posting job openings.
Wait, really? Where does it begin then?
It begins with defining the work.
Ah, okay. The text calls this triage. They break the work down into these rigid categories.
Right. It's all about prioritization.
Yeah, so the absolute highest priority is essential operations, like the core production or delivery, and safety and compliance. Because obviously, if those fail, the business collapses or people get hurt.
Exactly. And then below that, they have what they call moderate high priorities,
which are administrative support and customer-facing continuity, right? Like keeping payroll running, answering client calls.
Yep, keeping the lights on administratively.
But looking at these triage categories, there is a final bucket called deferrable work, and it's ranked as low priority.
So, wait, are you telling me a business will deliberately look at an entire department and just choose to let it sit completely empty?
I mean, it's one of the hardest decisions a management team has to make. But, yeah.
Yes.
That's wild.
Protecting the most consequential functions is literally the only way a labor continuity plan survives. If you try to maintain 100% of your normal operations with a replacement workforce, you just stretch your resources to the breaking point.
But what if that deferrable work is, I don't know, your customer complaint line or processing returns? You're just letting the phones ring and hoping your customers forgive you when the strike is over.
Pretty much. If the alternative is pulling a trained supervisor away from a critical safety operation just to go monitor a customer service desk, then yeah, you let the phones ring.
Wow. Okay. That makes sense when you put it like that.
Yeah.
The text actually highlights that overstaffing without enough trained supervisors is a disastrous mistake. I mean, think about it. A massive crowd of replacement workers wandering around a facility without clear direction.
Yeah, that sounds like a nightmare.
It's not a solution at all. It is a profound safety hazard. You have to let the non-essential work sit empty so your management team can focus entirely on overseeing the critical tasks.
Okay, so while you are mapping out these critical tasks, the text points out a very specific, almost hidden danger during the triage phase, and that's the single point of failure.
Oh, yeah. Every organization has them, and strikes violently expose them.
How so?
Well, you might look at a department's roster and think, okay, this is fully covered by our replacement plan. But then you realize your entire production line relies on one specific maintenance technician.
Oh, like the one guy who knows the exact quirk of how to unjam the main conveyor belt.
Exactly. Or you have one veteran dispatcher who holds all the customer routing preferences in their head, and it's not actually in the computer system.
Oh, wow. So when you are mapping essential roles, you aren't just counting heads. You are actively hunting for those single points of failure.
Right. So you can build contingencies, like, you know, writing down the conveyor belt bypass codes before the workers actually walk out the door.
That is the essence of strike preparation, really. You are extracting institutional knowledge before it leaves the building.
Precisely.
Okay, so triaging the work solves the what and the who.
Yeah.
But the source hints that actually bringing these specific people into the building is a highly volatile process. The guide goes out of its way to clarify that strike staffing is not standard temporary labor.
No, not even close. You aren't just calling a local agency to cover someone's maternity leave.
Right.
Standard temporary labor is designed for predictable, isolated gaps. Strike staffing, on the other hand, means stepping into a literal pressure cooker.
Yeah, it involves highly compressed mobilization, immense legal scrutiny, and just intense public attention.
Plus, you are bringing people into an environment where the usual workforce actively wants them to fail.
Right, they are literally outside protesting.
Exactly. So because of that reality, the onboarding process has to be incredibly fast. But the golden rule is that safety standards cannot be lowered by a single inch.
To achieve that, the manual details a very specific four-layer sequence for fast-track onboarding.
Right, the four layers.
Yeah, so layer one is site orientation, which is literally just establishing the physical boundaries, like where to enter, where to park safely, what zones are restricted.
The basics.
Yeah. Layer two is role orientation, defining the specific duties, the necessary tools, and the baseline quality standards. But layer three focuses on safety orientation. And the manual emphasizes giving these temporary workers stop work authority.
This is such a critical point.
Okay, let's unpack this, though. Let's be realistic about this. You have a replacement worker who has just flown in. They're making premium strike pay, and they want to prove their worth.
Right.
Are they actually going to walk up to a massive, complicated machine on day one and hit the big red stop button? I mean, they have to be terrified of getting fired for slowing down production.
And that is the exact psychological hurdle the onboarding has to overcome.
Okay, so how do they do that?
The onboarding process must explicitly empower them. Usually this means having senior management stand up in front of everyone and literally say, "We expect you to stop the line if you see a hazard, and you will not be penalized."
Oh, so it comes from the very top.
It has to. Because if you don't build that safety culture in the first hour, a replacement worker will absolutely try to push through a dangerous situation just to hit a quota.
And that is when catastrophic injuries happen.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But it's layer four that really, I don't know, shifts the paradigm for me. Conduct orientation.
Yes. Conduct.
This dictates how replacement workers are expected to behave, specifically when they're at picket lines or dealing with high-tension situations.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is the manual groups conduct under physical safety, not HR.
That's because conduct is absolutely a physical safety protocol in this environment. It's not just about being polite.
Right.
The manual frames professional restraint as a protective mechanism. The trainers are explicitly telling these workers, do not argue, do not make gestures, do not pull out your phone to film people, and do not engage in any taunting when you cross that line.
Because a single flipped bird from a bus window can turn a loud but peaceful picket line into a physical riot.
Precisely. An inappropriate gesture escalates the crowd, which disrupts the secure environment, which in turn forces the entire operation to halt. It is a chain reaction.
Wow.
And this ties into a really vital expectation management point for employers. They have to expect stable coverage rather than perfect efficiency early on.
Right, because these people don't know the building yet.
Exactly. You have capable people, but they do not know the facility's informal workflows. If you demand perfect efficiency on day one, you incentivize rushing, which compromises both safety and conduct.
So the workers are trained. They know the safety protocols. They know where the stop button is. And they know to maintain absolute professional restraint. But to actually get to their workstations, they have to physically cross the threshold of the disruption.
They have to get past the picket line.
Yeah. And this is where the security pillar's philosophy really comes into focus. The text explicitly states the purpose of strike security is not intimidation.
That is a crucial operational distinction.
Really? How so?
The manual insists that the true purpose of security in this context is controlled movement, de-escalation, and incident documentation. Security personnel must deeply understand the difference between presence and provocation.
Oh, I see.
If a security team shows up in full tactical gear trying to look intimidating, they are actively working against the company's best interests by inflaming an already tense crowd.
But let me advocate for the listener who might be a bit skeptical here.
Yeah.
It is very easy to write, stay neutral, and de-escalate in a corporate manual. In reality, you have a highly emotional environment. People's livelihoods are at stake, right? And they are understandably angry. They might be screaming right in the faces of the security guards. So how does a security team actually prevent escalation without looking like they are backing down or losing control of the facility's perimeter?
Well, it requires highly specialized training that, honestly, standard security guards rarely possess. The source outlines a strict de-escalation model.
What does that look like?
It relies on calm, repetitive verbal communication, totally consistent access procedures, and rigid limits on unauthorized engagement. The security team should never debate the picketers.
So no arguing back?
Never. They should never discuss the merits of the union's demands. Their job is simply to keep the gate functioning safely and document any property damage or illegal blocking of access.
Sorry.
They are trained to be, basically, a brick wall of calm.
A brick wall of calm. I like that. And that documentation isn't just for insurance purposes either. The manual stresses that the legal framework surrounding strike replacements is a massive legal minefield.
It is incredibly fragile. Labor law varies wildly depending on where you are, but the legality of hiring replacements often hinges on the specific nature of the strike itself.
Right. They mention a massive legal distinction between an economic strike and an unfair labor practice strike, often called a ULP.
Yes. An economic strike is usually a dispute over wages or benefits.
And what makes that distinction a minefield for the employer, like practically speaking?
Well, if the strike is purely economic, employers generally have the right to hire permanent replacements to keep the business running.
Okay.
But if the employer commits an unfair labor practice during the strike, the legal status flips. If it becomes a ULP strike, the company is suddenly obligated to reinstate the striking workers the moment they offer to return.
Wait, meaning what? They have to fire all the replacements.
Exactly. They have to fire all the permanent replacements, and the company might owe massive amounts of back pay.
Wow. So a single mistake at the gate can change the entire legal definition of the strike.
Yes, exactly. The manual states the safest operational posture for the employer is Disciplined neutrality.
Disciplined neutrality, that's a great term.
It really is, because think about it. If a security guard or a shift manager gets frustrated at the gate and yells at a picketer, like, you guys are losing your jobs tomorrow.
Just letting off steam?
Right, but that is not just letting off steam. That can be legally construed as a threat or retaliation. You have just handed the union evidence to convert your economic strike into a ULP strike.
Unbelievable. So one careless sentence from an untrained guard can literally cost a company millions of dollars and upend their entire labor strategy.
It happens more often than you'd think.
Discipline neutrality. Maintaining it across an entire organization, though, sounds nearly impossible. The source emphasizes that communication failures are completely deadly to this neutrality.
Absolutely.
Because you have so many different stakeholders involved. You have the replacement workers, the security team, the non-striking corporate employees who are just trying to come to the office, your vendors, and obviously your customers.
And every single one of those groups needs tailored factual updates. If communication breaks down, discipline neutrality collapses right into chaos.
Give me an example of how that breaks down.
Okay, imagine a scenario where a vendor isn't informed that the main delivery gate is currently blocked by a legal picket line.
Okay.
Their delivery truck pulls up, gets surrounded by angry striking workers, and the driver panics. Now you have a safety incident, a blocked public road, and a vendor who might literally refuse to deliver to you ever again.
Oh, man. Or a customer gets a panicked, speculative email from an account manager instead of a calm, factual update about delivery timelines. They lose confidence and take their business elsewhere.
Precisely. The communication has to be relentlessly factual and non-speculative across the board.
Which really perfectly illustrates how all these high-level strategies, you know, the legal compliance, the discipline neutrality, the safety culture, they are entirely dependent on the invisible glue of the operation.
The logistics.
The logistics. You can have the most skilled replacement workers, the tightest security, and a perfectly neutral posture. But if the mundane background logistics crack under pressure, the whole plan falls apart.
It really does.
It's like planning a massive corporate retreat, right? You have to handle transportation, lodging, and catering. Except in this scenario, half the people outside the venue are incredibly angry, your caterers might not be able to cross the street without a full security escort, and a health inspector just showed up unannounced. The logistical puzzle is mind-boggling.
It is. The source stresses that strike security and staffing logistics must be planned concurrently.
They can't be separate teams just doing their own thing.
Exactly. They cannot be siloed. If the staffing coordinator decides to bus in 50 replacement workers for a shift change at 6 a.m., but the security team wasn't informed to clear and secure a specific gate for that incoming shuttle bus.
Oh, I see where this is going.
You instantly have crisis. The bus is stuck in traffic, the workers inside are exposed to harassment, and the shift inside the plant doesn't get relieved.
Which brings up a really fascinating point from the manual fatigue management. Because when we think of a strike, we think of the drama at the gate. We don't really think about the fact that the people inside might actually be trapped there.
Yeah, strikes create mandatory overtime and extended schedules. Replacement workers and non-striking staff are operating in a high-stress, very unfamiliar environment.
So they get exhausted fast.
Right. And the logistical plan has to meticulously cover fatigue management. This means arranging secure lodging, sometimes even setting up cots inside the facility if crossing the line daily is just too dangerous.
Wow, people literally sleeping on the factory floor.
Sometimes, yes. It also means organizing secure meal deliveries because workers cannot simply walk down the street to grab a sandwich for lunch.
Because they'd have to cross the picket line again.
Exactly.
And you have to dictate mandatory rest periods. Because if you push a replacement workforce to exhaustion just to keep the production numbers up, your safety incidents will spike, which brings the operation to a grinding halt anyway.
This logistical burden is exactly why the manual warns employers that selecting a staffing or security provider strictly based on cost is a total trap.
The lowest bidder trap.
Yep. If an executive just looks at the bottom line and goes with the lowest bidder, they might sign a contract with a company that has no national deployment capacity, poor legal compliance, and zero logistical readiness.
So when the pressure hits and the meals don't show up,
that cheap contract becomes the most expensive mistake the company can make.
And the true test of that logistical readiness is how a provider handles what the manual calls edge cases.
Ah, the edge cases.
Yeah, these are the unexpected variables that disrupt even the most meticulously planned continuity operations.
And edge cases are inevitable. I mean, What happens if the union decides to walk out 12 hours earlier than they originally announced?
Oh, that would be chaotic.
Or what if a massive snowstorm hits, making it literally impossible for your outdoor security perimeter team to safely maintain their posts?
Right. What if a regulatory agency, like OSHA, receives an anonymous complaint and conducts a sudden, unannounced inspection right in the middle of all this disruption?
Exactly. You can't possibly write a manual that covers every potential weather event, supply chain failure, or surprise inspection.
So how does an operation survive those edge cases?
You survive by defining authority ahead of time.
Predefined authority.
Yes. The guide insists that predefined authority is the only defense against edge cases. When chaos hits, who specifically has the authority to reroute a vendor truck to an off-site warehouse?
Oh, I see.
Who has the absolute power to pause a production line if staffing suddenly drops below a safe threshold due to an illness?
You can't be waiting around for approval.
Exactly. If a shift supervisor has to spend 2 hours calling executives in another state to get permission to act during an edge case, the system has already failed. Decisions must be decentralized to the people on the ground.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? When we look at this entire blueprint, from the twin pillars of staffing and security, to the painful triage of essential roles, the razor-thin legal line of discipline neutrality, and the mind-boggling logistical puzzle of feeding and housing a shadow workforce.
It means that managing a labor disruption is far more than just an HR dispute or a physical security challenge. It is an active, highly sensitive operational ecosystem.
Where everything touches everything else.
Yes, every single moving part is connected. How a meal is delivered to a replacement worker on a 12-hour shift impacts their fatigue. Their fatigue impacts their safety compliance. Their safety compliance impacts the legal standing of the entire operation.
It's all linked.
It requires an employer to view their own business through a completely alien operational lens, prioritizing absolute survival and safety over standard efficiency.
Understanding this hidden machinery completely changes how you will view the next labor dispute you see on the evening news.
It really does.
When the camera pans across a picket line, you won't just see the signs, the chanting, and the local politicians giving speeches. You'll look past those gates and understand the massive, tightly orchestrated logistical apparatus operating in the background.
Yeah, you'll see the security guards practicing discipline neutrality, the triage happening in the boardroom, and the incredibly fragile ecosystem functioning just to keep the lights on.
It is a profound shift in perspective. You realize how delicate normal operations really are, and how much invisible, exhausting effort goes into workforce continuity when the system breaks down.
Yes, Millie.
I want to leave you with one final provocative thought. The manual briefly touches on a concept called demobilization.
Right, the process of transitioning the work back to the returning employees.
Yeah, once a contract is finally signed and the strike ends. They talk about the logistics of closing out security details and preserving legal documentation. But think about the human element of that demobilization.
Oh.
What happens on day one, the morning after the strike is officially over? The replacement workers pack up their gear and leave in the middle of the night. The returning employees, who have been standing outside in the cold for weeks, have to walk back into their facility.
Right.
They have to stand at their machines, log into their computers, and look around at a workplace that successfully ran without them.
Mm. How long does that invisible tension linger in the break room?
Managing the strike is a logistical marvel, but repairing the culture after the gates unlock, that is a completely different challenge.
Something to mull over the next time you see a strike reach a settlement. Until our next deep dive, keep questioning how the world around you really works.